never leaves, and so it diminishes the emission energy. But it doesn't quite correlate completely with efficiency. So different antennas have different efficiencies, and it's practically impossible to measure them. You would require an incredible investment. But again, in your case, part of the problem is not anything to do with the output of your transmitter. It's the setting of your microphone. Either you're not talking loud enough to the microphone element, or the audio microphone gain is set too low. And so if you set your microphone low and you have ambient sound noises in your environment, you hear a lot, it can cause problems. But if you had your microphone set for a higher gain, perhaps it would kind of lessen the background noise that's either produced by an ambient thing or inside your radio, or I don't know. It doesn't really sound like the usual hiss of not capturing the repeater's receiver. So I don't think it's a problem with the amount of energy getting to the repeater. I think there is something else going on that's superimposing a very unusual background noise signal.
Very good, very good. I so much appreciate. This is a new unit that I'm using, FT3185 Yesu. I'm not too familiar with it yet, but I skipped the section about gain on the microphone. I'm going to take a couple of minutes right now and go back to the manual and try to increase the gain on the manual, see if the quality of the audio improves. Thanks.
You're welcome, Andreas. Did you have another question before you want to call it a night?
Well, I'm not calling it a night. I said I'm going to adjust the gain on the mic, talk to you again, and transmit again, and see if it improves.
Okay, we'll stand by. This is AAC2G, other way.
WA2VFM with a question, please.
Sure.
Good evening. I was on the web and I saw MFJ appears to have a website. I thought they were out of business, but it says copyright 2025. Would you know anything at all whether they're back in business or someone took them over?
As far as I'm aware, they didn't really just kind of leave the business. They're on their way out. The way that they said they were going to maintain inventory, they weren't going to kind of sell it off on the cheap, so they will be selling off their equipment, but they won't be producing or manufacturing anything new. So when they finally run out of stock, they'll shut down. But until then, they're maintaining their website. They're selling through their website. They're selling through the retail distributors as well.
Well, I appreciate that very much. It's a shame. I mean, we all grew up buying MFJ tuners, MFJ this, meters, and what have you. It's a real shame. But thank you for the information. I appreciate that. WA2VFM, take care.
Are
you there?
Yes, I am there. You're much
okay,
louder.
I changed the mic gain from normal to max. How does it sound now, the quality of the audio?
Much better, much better. Because I heard the strange noise in the background before, I can just barely make it out, but my guess would be that if this was a couple of days later and I forgot what it sounded like, I wouldn't even be able to perceive it. So it sounds a lot better.
Yeah, you know what happens? The power supply that changes the 120 to 13 volts from time to time goes on, and I was wondering if that interferes with the noise, you know. But anyway, thanks a lot for the this point. It was pretty good. I changed. I'm going to keep the mic gain to max, like you said, since it sounds much better. But I got a couple more questions after that.
Okay, what's the next one then?
Yeah, I want to set up a good antenna on my pickup truck and get a good unit. I'm new into this, you know, just all over the place. So I'm trying to get better and better equipment, better antennas, better receptions, whatever. So what's a good recommendation for a 2-meter, 70-centimeter unit, as well as a good mobile antenna that will fit on a pickup truck?
Okay, I usually don't kind of keep a list of things like that. I tend not to recommend because, you know, some people get a little antsy of why I recommended one thing over it. I think you should more likely focus on manufacturers. Try and stay away from Chinese antennas. Some of them, I'm sure, are very, very good and inexpensive, but you never know which ones are which. So Diamond, and there are a couple other brand names that for some odd reason I've missed track. But, you know, go to some place like a DX engineering site. They usually don't have crappy stuff, and you'll get a good idea of what's around. Look at some of the reviews on the Internet. They all kind of functionally are similar, you know, within, you know, the length of the antenna and such. There's two major mounting methods. There's a method that you basically punch a hole in the chassis, in the metal part of your car, and you mount it that way, the most secure. If you don't want to punch holes in your car, you can use a magnetic mount, but they're a little bit more fragile than the NMO mounts. If anyone out there has a favorite mobile antenna that they would like to recommend to Andreas, feel free, though.
ADTDU. You said about the diamond antennas. I got the point about staying away from Chinese-make equipment or anything. Actually, today I had to return some stuff I bought from Amazon, Chinese-made connectors, PL259s and all. They wouldn't even fit in the hole. And it messed up the whole transmission. I received it yesterday, and I returned it today. So I know the whole thing about low-quality Chinese products. But I didn't get it clear as to whether you said that diamond antennas are of no good quality because they're Chinese, or if you didn't say that.
No, I didn't say that. I recommend diamond antennas. They are definitely not Chinese unless they changed, got bought up since last. I looked at them, which I doubt. And there's one or two other brands that are kind of infamous. There's another brand that I just cannot recall the damn name, that's similar in quality and price point than Diamond. So those two manufacturers are probably the best to look at. Again, I would look at DX Engineering even if you don't want to buy it from them for whatever reason, because they tend to pre-select out the cheap garbage. And the same thing would go with connectors. You know, unfortunately, you would end up paying more for the connector, but my guess would be there would be a zero chance of these connectors being poorly made so that the screw thread is ever so slightly out of alignment. You know, Chinese connectors were infamous for that. I'm sort of surprised that they're still screwing around that way, but that's the way it was in the good old days, that you would just go crazy trying to screw those connectors together to each other.
What do you think of the Comet antennas?
Yeah, that's the other brand that I couldn't recall. Yeah, it's fine. I've used Comet. They're good quality. So I would put them in the same category pretty much as Diamond. You know, there are people, there are fanboy types that for whatever reason randomly have decided that Comet is better than the, you know, Comet is the one that's better and the other one is better, and, you know, people like to argue about it. But they're so close to each other that they're equivalent in my mind.
AD2DU?
Yes, Alex.
If he's looking for a simple recommendation, I think your brands are accurate with Diamond and with the other one, Comet. But a 19-inch magnet mount antenna is a great starting point. You just stick it on top of the car, and because likely I think you're going to probably move the radio around in your car a couple times, you're not going to find the perfect mount. And a 19-inch mag mount is cheap, and you can use it for other stuff. I used to use it on a fire escape, or you can stick it on a pie tin if you and have a separate antenna somewhere. But and you just run the wire out the door and figure it out later. AD2 to you.
Yeah, that's an option. It sort of depends on whether you want something to never fall off of your car. You know, if you want something where the car will fall apart before the mount will, then an NMO where you punch a hole through the car is the way to go. But magnetic mounts are certainly convenient. In some people's cases, don't particularly like them because it can scratch the finish of the car. So if you're very, very, concerned about things like that, you might want to look into other mounting systems that kind of swing to fenders and such, so that, it's neither a magnet mount nor a hole punched through your the shell of your car. So there's a bunch of different ways. It depends upon how bulletproof you want your mount to be, that it'll never fall off, or that you can reposition it with relative ease.
I got one more question, Roy.
Okay.
Okay, looking at the coaxial cables to use for my base units, there's nothing available on RG8 on Amazon. Most of them are RG8X, which has a lot more losses. But the question is whether it's a good idea to use LMR400. Seems to be the best quality as far as minimal losses. But what's the drawback? That's got to be like a give and take there.
Yes, the give and take is it's more expensive. That's the only give or take. I mean, it's thicker, it's a little bit less flexible, I think it's better weatherproofing, and it certainly has somewhat less attenuation losses. And for UHF, that's kind of important. It's not that important. A lot of hams use LMR 400 for their HF requirements, so the attenuation losses are much lower using HF rather than UHF, but still, I think LMR 400 is a great price.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Any other questions, Andreas, for tonight?
Well, I'm overwhelmed with answers, so I gotta digest all of this before I make the next move, you know?
Sure, I understand. You know where to find us.
You know, I just installed one of them, antenna switch or splitter, because I got, for the base system, I got one antenna out there and two units inside, and the old one I used to have, it's an MFJ 1700 something. It's got a position for ground. So like if there's a storm coming or something, you disconnect your antenna, you switch it to ground, nothing's connected, you're good to go. I ordered a new one. It just has choice of A or B. You are either on the one unit or the other from the antenna. There is no way to disconnect from the antenna outside. I'm looking for one of them old MFJ 1700s.
Yeah, that's I don't know if anyone actually sells any of those things these days. You know, some people who are very mindful of lightning strikes and such have a habit of actually disassembling their switches and putting it to outside so that it, you know, doesn't kind of get into your house. Because even if you kind of switch it to ground, you know, the switch is inside your house. When lightning comes inside your house, it's somewhat difficult to get rid of it. So, you know, it's of dubious value, again, if the switch is already inside your house. So that's probably why they don't take up the additional switch space. Nowadays, you know, if there's three switch positions, they connect them to operate for three transmission lines.
Well, you know, I just installed an SP1000 lightning arrestor. I just finished, actually, like about an hour ago from the new antenna, and I grounded it with like an 8-foot ground bar into the ground from the lightning arrestor. So that's one, the first step of defense, you know, in case something happens. So if anything goes through and it comes to the antenna switch, if it's got the off position or the ground position, then you're safe. Nothing is going to kill your equipment, you know, if anything happens. But if it doesn't have that center position for ground, which I do have a ground wire from the switch to the lightning arrestor, because it has that, which goes back to the outdoor ground bar. You know, so I'm looking. I borrowed the one I'm using, the MFJ 1700. So I'm looking for one. Anyway, that's the point I'm trying to make, that they don't make this safe equipment anymore.
Again, what I'm trying to get across is you're expecting lightning to be polite enough to do a loop-de-loop. It's going through your transmission line. It's going inside your shack. It's going over to your switch, which is then set to ground that. Oh, well, and the ground is outside, so it's you're wiring it so that it will then go to ground by taking a long path back out of your shack and down to ground. So the problem is that once you've kind of invited the lightning inside your shack, it's up to the lightning to decide if it wants to jump to some other ground that's closer and shorter. And you could never be terribly sure whether that's going to be that connection that you made outside again. It may want to go through your house, unfortunately, even though you've supplied it with a really nice ground elsewhere.
Okay, from what I gather then, it's an overkill to look for an antenna switch that has a ground to ground it to the lightning arrestor so that it goes back out. All right, good to know. So I'll stop looking for one.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why they don't make them anymore. You know, people, you know, there's a lot of people who aren't careful at all. They don't consider ground, unfortunately. So I guess there's less profit to be made. So, you know, if you find one, and you're probably going to have to find an old one, and, you know, there might be a degree of corrosion and mechanical problems because they're old. But I don't think modern ones, like I said before, have that. I mean, you can jury-rig something. You can get a three-position switch and just connect the one of the positions instead of to the radios to a ground and, you know, run the ground outdoors. You can kind of mimic it. But again, you're kind of tempting fate. It's a solution. It's a belt and suspenders type of redundant solution that's not quite as good as simply, if you really want to be safe, you kind of take the coax wire that's coming into your shack, put a cover on it, and disconnect the cover on it, and have it hang loose outside. Because that's probably the biggest belt and suspenders, highest safety factor you can do as far as lightning protection, rather than have a loop around ground that goes through your antenna switches that are inside your shack.
Very good. Thank you very much. I guess it was a very good idea to use a three position and use one of them positions as the grounding one. Thanks a lot, Roy. That's all for the night. I'll be standing by listening. Thanks a lot again.
Okay. You're welcome, Andreas. Anytime. You know where to find us. Thank you for participating. Well, Wesley, I think it's your turn.
Okay, and three, see, and how am I coming out, Dr. Roy?
You're very bassy for some reason. You got no treble.
I'm gonna try to increase it a little bit, but it's gonna be too much probably. It's gonna be too much probably. Okay. How about now? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, Dr. Roy.
There's a weird artifact on it for some strange reason. It doesn't sound like the treble is the problem, but it almost sounds like it's kind of going in and going out very quickly.
Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. How about now?
It's okay. I mean, it's still a little on the bassy side, but it's okay.
So we have 7 points today. One of them is one ham radio operator passes away following electrocution accident in Chicora Cemetery in Dune, North Carolina. So that was Steve VE9CF. Steve VE. 9CF was the one who reported this, and that was Dave W4JL. So Dave, July 4th, 2025, decided that he's going to go to Dune, North Carolina, and have some transmission in the park. And he decided to play with mass, but he had a mass either from aluminum or carbon based. Anyhow, it was conductive, and he was successfully on the park, having QSO with many ham radio operators. Still, he decided that this is enough, and let's take down the masts. And he accidentally touched the high voltage wire. I'm not sure if that was the high voltage wire or just high voltage wire. Not going into the specific, but anyhow, it's a tragic story. It's a tragic story, right? So, and Evan Comp, country citizen and amateur radio hobbyist, died in freak accident in Chicora Civil War Cemetery at Alvarezboro Battlefield on the morning of Independence Day. That's the report. Not much to comment on it, but if somebody wants to comment, go ahead. Okay. So, playing with antennas in the field, they put a or any other event might be dangerous. Keep in mind, look at the high voltage wires. Now, the next one is FTX1. I have made the news that was a few weeks ago, that 2 weeks ago, that FTX1 and FTX1 Optima, which is 100 watts radio, exactly the same as FTX1, but the FTX1 is a QRP, had problems with the software. So the news is now that they added APRS message function, which wasn't present, so you actually couldn't use it. Supports Atlas 120A AutoTune FTX1 Optima only. Displays the selected HF antenna connector number at the top of the screen. Let me drop. Okay. Fix issue of GPS coordinates not being displayed correctly. Improve noise blanker characteristic. Fix issue with volume not being adjustable while CW message or voice memory screen is displayed. Fix issue with sub site receiving sound being output during split operation. I'm not sure if split operation is so popular. Anyhow, fix issue with setting menu not being backed up to SD card properly, and some other minor fixes. So somebody wants to buy the radio, already purchased the radio, so we're talking about FTX1. Here is a new software, you can download it and fix most of the bugs there. Any questions? Okay, the third one. 100 years anniversary transmission from SAQ Grimeton VLF transmitter. I'm into VLF and ULF. So that was July 2nd, 2025 at 8:20 UTC time. And a few words just for those who cares about Alexanderson transmitter, which was mechanical, pre-electronic mechanical transmitter. It was dynamo. So instead of swimming close to Velberg in Holland in early long-wave transatlantic, wireless telegraphy station was built in 1922-1924, and it was preserved as historical site. From 1920 to 1940, it was used to transmit telegraphic Morse code, that's what it says in here, to North America and Long Island and other countries. During World War II, it was Sweden's only telecommunication link. And a few words about the Alexanderson transmitter. So Ernst Alexanderson, in 1904, he was a PhD doctor. He designed alternating current radio transmitter. It was one of the first couple of generating continuous radio waves. So we had not A1, we had A2, so it was continuous carrier. And it was AM. Okay. It was used since 1910 till 1945, I believe. The frequency of operation was 9 kilohertz, perfect for me, 15 kilohertz, 14 kilohertz, and 20 kilohertz. So there was plenty of those transmitters, but this is the only one that remains solid and working condition. Now, in order to have that transmitter working, you need quite a good few hours of maintenance ends, after 2-3 hours, he needs to add oil to the bearings. Because you're going to have a sounding alarm. So, Dr. Roy, I know you don't have a comment, but just a few words.
Well, okay, a few words. This is a few words. You know, I mean, it's all well and good. We seem to be kind of talking about it every year for some strange reason. You know, as far as history goes, I'm much more interested in what happened 5,000 years ago than 100 years ago. To each their own. I understand different people have different interests, but we seem to be talking about this place every year.
Oh, yes, we do. We do. It's an event many people are waiting for, although it is repeated, but you see different faces. You see people who died, who didn't die yet. Let me put it this way, because most of those guys are 70-plus years old guys. So it's interesting, and plenty of them are high-quality not only ham radio amateurs, but engineers who retired. The next one, it is titled for Roy. So FCC slams CB radio user with $25,000 fine for CB radio, so for misuse. So it looks like CB doesn't require the license. If you don't mind to comment on it. Back to you, Dr. Wright.
Yeah, well, apparently if you buy a shiny new radio, the license is kind of included as part of the literature, and the way the law seems to work is that if you then turn on your newly bought CB or GMRS equipment, you automatically are licensed, but you've accepted the limitations of your license. This particular guy did not. This particular guy, and I think this is the third time he screwed up. Apparently, the FCC had recorded obnoxious transmissions on the CB band for over 30 minutes. He operated over people trying to use the channel. He broadcast instead of transmitted back and forth to another person. So by right of that third violation, they decided to fine him $25,000. We had a person who everyone was very familiar with here on Limark's repeaters, who also was fined by the FCC. But unfortunately, he found a solution to that problem that I wouldn't wish on anyone, which was to become a silent key.
Okay, can do it again. In addition to what Dr. Roy said, interesting personality of that gentleman working on CW. Paulina, because this was his name, also made headlines in national media in 2012 when he walked into Gresham, Oregon McDonald's demanding a refund for a hamburger that he ordered without onions. He had called the restaurant to request the refund, and they offered a refund and new hamburger without onion. So he received full refund. He got hamburger, but the first hamburger was already eaten by him. So he eaten the hamburger, so staff refused.
I'm
sorry. The exact line is like that. When he arrived food that we found, according to police reports, he had already eaten the hamburger, so staff refused to provide him with a refund for replacement sandwich. Okay, so that's the exact line. But there was many of things like that. Leon got mad and threw soda in the manager's face, broke glass and smashed whatever. So, I spoke to my wife, psychologist. It looks like it is aggressive ego and narcissism. They are also related one to each other. Narcissistic people may attack others aggressively due to feelings of superiority and entitlement. When hurt, a narcissist may experience a narcissistic injury and respond with manipulation tactics. How do we know that from the big guy that is very much popular right now? Any questions? And to XJN. Okay, so now technicality, how to determine transformers winding phase dot relation resonance and operational frequency. And the question is, to the audience, I assume that Dr. Roy knows all of the answers, and to the audience, if nobody answers, then please, Dr. Roy, pick up. Why the phase relation of transformer primary and secondary winding is important? Anybody willing to answer? It's such an easy question, guys. Why the phase relation of transformer primary and secondary winding is important? Please provide the answer.
Well, unfortunately, the you sent me a YouTube that started in the middle. Usually you do that because the stuff at the beginning wasn't of any, had no point in it. Except that I think it did have the point in it, because the stuff that I watched on the video didn't have any point of it. He used an oscilloscope, fine. How do you check the polarity without the oscilloscope? So, I mean, most of us don't have oscilloscopes. I don't have an oscilloscope. I'm sure if I took a poll, you probably would be the only one listening right now with an oscilloscope.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But I formulated the question, and I'm going to provide the answer. So why the phase relation of transformer primary and secondary winding is important? Well, polarity is important because it ensures that voltages are properly aligned with the, when transformers are connected in series or parallel, ensuring a safe operation and preventing short circuits or equipment damage. So in other words, a young boy I was many years ago, noticed that he has some handy transformers, and one has 12 volts and the other one has 8 volts. But I was in need of 20 volts. So what I did is I connected primary in parallel and secondary of those transformers in series. And then I find out that, well, I don't have a voltage. But when I reverse without any oscilloscope, anything at all, when I reversed the leads of one of the transformers, all of a sudden I've noticed that I have a 20 volts. So that was 12 plus 8. So that's why it is important to have a phase and polarity observed. Now, the second question I have is, why do we attempt to connect transformers in series or parallel? Well, that's already provided the answers for it. But there are so many applications. Transformer connected in series or parallel in power system handle different types of load demands. Connecting transformers in parallel is important for load sharing system reliability and future expansion. Well, there are many things we can think about it. But there was one, the heating element of tube cathode, which is, if I remember correctly, 6.3 volts, may need harm to improvise the right voltage, right current, or both. The need for 12-volt AC at the right current and so on. And the question to the audience, what is resonance transformer? Okay, no answer. A resonance transformer is a transformer in which one or both windings have a real or mostly intentional internal capacitor or capacitance, because you have a capacitance between the winds and you have a capacitance between the windings. So you have a capacitor or capacitance across it, and it acts as a regulator circuit. But that is only one of its applications. There are plenty of them. Another question, what is the difference between resonant and operational frequency of a transformer? Anybody wants to provide the answer? Okay, no answer. So the resonant frequency of the transformer is the frequency at which it resonates, while the operational frequency is the frequency at which transformer is used. The resonance frequency is determined by the electrical characteristic of the transformer winding, and it can affect the frequency response of the transformer. And when we talk about the antennas, operating frequency is the frequency at which you want antenna to resonate. Resonating frequency is the frequency at which the antenna resonates. So most of the time, you will get resonating frequency at less than operating frequency due to the various parameters that this would be. Fringing fields. Oh, gosh. What is fringing fields? Bending of electric and magnetic field lines at the edges of conducting surfaces, such capacitors, antennas, leading to non-uniform field distribution. So that would be the easiest way to explain that. And when we're talking about hold on, let me drop. Okay. And when we're talking about transformers, ideally, most transformers should have constant voltage gain or attenuation across the entire operational frequency range. However, this does not happen due to the parasitic elements that are present in the transformer, namely leakage or magnetizing inductances, the interwindings capacitance, and the windings resistor. There is a special application for saturable transformers, if somebody is interested. But those they are sometimes called reactors, not the transformers. And it is a transformer used in form of variable inductors. In this type of adjustable voltage DC, in this type, an adjustable DC voltage source is applied on the primary winding, so you have some sort of bias voltage. I remember I was playing a long time ago, but that was very much popular. If somebody remembered the magnetic amplifiers, there was no transistors, no tubes, no valves, no nothing. It was just a transformer. The transformer was used to amplify the signal. It was something that couldn't be damaged. No matter how much you tried to damage, you couldn't damage, and it was in World War II, it was used by Germans to announce the messages, but also by Russians. I'm not sure if that was used during the Second World War in the United States of America, but definitely in the 50s and 60s it was. Dr. Roy, do you recall any usage of magnetic amplifiers?
No, not particularly.
Okay. So, is the transformer resonant frequency always lower than operating frequency? Well, not always lower. What is saturation of the transformer? Maybe somebody wants to respond to that. Okay, it doesn't look like so. The saturation in the transformer occurs when the magnetic core reaches its limit in carrying the magnetic flux. At this point, the core material is fully magnetized and cannot carry any more flux, resulting decrease in inductance. For the old guys, do you remember those transformers that were made not from core, but not from the ferrite core, but from the plates? And the plates were painted to not short one with the other, and then they use a special alloy for it. Another question, is the transformer saturation happening at its resonance or operational frequency? So the answer would be transformer saturation can occur in both. But more close to ham radio, where in antenna ham use transformers? Anybody wants to respond? Okay, Dr. Roy, where in antennas ham use transformers and why?
I assume you're alluding to balance that transform impedances.
That is correct. So ham radio operators use transformers impedance matching between the output of transceiver and antenna, or between the transceiver and the input of the tuner, to feed beams and wire antennas with specific transformation ratios for self-installation, where space and visibility are of concern, and to cover multiple bands with a single antenna. And I'm not sure if anyone from you remember W3DGG, and that was antenna that had a traps. But Dr. Roy know many other antennas that use traps, Dr. Roy.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about antennas that utilize traps to be multi-band. Some people find that they're a weak point. Given enough time and not enough care, they corrode and cause problems and are the point of trouble for those types of multiband antennas. They're still used very frequently. We must have talked about it four or five months ago, and I'm sure we'll talk about trap antennas in the future as well. They come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. There are trap-based Yagis. There are trap-based verticals, you know, and all kinds of odd antennas that utilize trap technology.
Okay. And the next one, I have to make an announcement before I go to the title of it. The material is about technology and has nothing to do with discussing politics. There are historical facts about farmers, technology, and companies promoting it with their products. Now, the title of the video was Trump Goes Mad as Farmers Shut Down Production in U.S. After Trump's Tariff. And there is a quote that I have to read under the video, and it says, John Deere is halting factory lines, its tractor going silent, and its farm freezing meat hardware as a 200% tariff slows even the most loyal American manufacturers are heading south. Trump goes mad as farmers shut down production in U.S. after Trump tariffs captures a moment where economic policy turned into economic panic, and so on and so on and so on. We're not about politics. So that's end of quote. And now for me. We secured packet transitioning to China with their magnificent spectrum analyzers, VNA generators, oscilloscopes. They didn't trigger any movement and protest, as it is about technology, not about where it is made. We are willing to trust the brand name despite where the device was made. 55 millions of investment of John, billions of, I'm sorry, of investment of John Deere in Mexico. New production line made 75,500 of employees lose their job. Despite the fact that the official states that they have only 30,000 employees. But there is an entire chain of connected businesses repairing, refurbishing whatsoever entities. So that caused about 300,000 of their family members to suffer loss of father or mother or both. Losing jobs and many businesses are closing. The entire cities that exist only because of John Deere manufacturing activity. Let me jump. Okay. And I have some additional material. John Deere has a production. So, I mean 300,000 people with families. We're talking about farmers, children in the schools. We're talking about people having mortgages whatsoever. Because John Deere was pushed out, and he doesn't want to give up. So we have facilities of John Deere in Moline, Iowa, Waterloo, Iowa, Davenport, Iowa, Delbrook, Iowa, Ankeny, Iowa, Horicon, Wisconsin, and then we have Moline, Illinois, Waterloo, Danport, Iowa, Wisconsin, and then we have a few facilities in China, Brazil, Canada, and in Canada we have British Columbia and Alberta, Canada. We're talking about the company that was founded in 1837 by blacksmith inventor John Deere. So this is the end of the history files. As I said, I'm not talking politics. It's just the history that is happening on our eyes. If something happened 5 seconds ago, the mosquito hit you, that's the history. Dr. Ray, your comment.
Well,
Well, again, I don't quite know how much of this has to do with technology. It has to do with economics. It has to do with politics. The agricultural sector is being smacked silly. Even the agricultural manufacturing machinery industry is being kicked in its backside. It's getting a lot of competition from, for the most part, I think, Chinese manufacturers. They sell products of maybe a little bit less quality, but at half the price or a third of the price. And so all these agricultural manufacturers are looking ways to cut corners. And for the most part, it tends to be by relocating their factory in the third world, which is the exact opposite of the whole point of supposedly the exercise. And then there's loads of problems with farmers because of all these kind of one day up, one day down tariffs. Everyone outside of the United States is making deals within themselves to buy and sell agricultural products and telling the United States not to be bothered. It's a mess. But again, it's more of an economical situation than it is a technological, as far as I perceive it.
Yeah. I'm not sure how much would add me repeating the quote of my wife that aggressive ego and narcissists are related. But anyhow, another, and that's the last point that I have for today. As part of fireworks facility explosion, and that was Tuesday. So we have a facility that is called Devastating Pyrotechnics. Devastating Pyrotechnics was devastated. Authorities say human remains have been found. That's, of course, seven people not accounted for. After the Tuesday explosion of fire at fireworks warehouse in Northern California community of Esparto. So we're talking about 80 square acres of land that was occupied by the company in rural area. On Friday, Yolo County officials announced that human remains were located after Coroner Division personnel were allowed to access the site for their investigation. The following day, officials confirmed that remains of the seven missing after the July 1st accident at Devastating Pyrotechnics were found. But those remains were beyond any recognition. So only, I believe, DNA analysis may say what belongs to whom. And that is only informational. 80 acres of land with several buildings, 14 I believe, and that includes a house that belongs to the facility, private house, apart from the commercial buildings, with the swimming pool in it and whatsoever. But anyhow, thank you very much for your time and your attention, and to XJ and Dr. Roy.
AC2GS. Well, thank you, Wesley. Thank you for all the participation that you do, all the things that you do here. I do like it. And we still have a little bit more time left, so if anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, feel free to hit that push to talk and ID yourselves. Okay, we'll give you guys one more chance. If you, like I said, we ordinarily would have 15 more minutes of this, but you know, someone has to be on the other end. So if anyone has any topics for discussion, any questions or any comments to make about anything related to amateur radio and science and technology, I wish I could tell you more about the delete docket of the FCC, but they've been at their mum. Testing 1, 2, 3. Am I on? Yeah, I just wanted to make sure because something, the repeater made some kind of a strange noise.